When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Let's go.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to Binge Town TV, and we are finally here to talk episode 7 and 8 of The Fall of the House of Usher, titled The Pit and the Pendulum and The Raven, of course. And I didn't actually realize that The Raven is an anagram of Verna, which is interesting.
Yeah.
Ooh, wow.
Yeah. She is like a personification of The Raven, which is great, which is obviously one of his old Eddie's good poems. But okay, so first things first, if you haven't seen 7 and 8, turn around. If you've only seen 7, turn around, because we're about to jump right the fuck in on all spoilers. But come back and follow Binge Town TV and hit subscribe, because Binge Town TV is our main feed. We have this separate feed for The Fall of the House of Usher, just so you know, it's easily searchable, but we drop every episode we do on Binge Town. We're currently doing Gen V, which is the spinoff of The Boys. We're doing Survivor, which is our first reality show. We just finished Wheel of Time and One Piece and all these good things. We've got tons of shows. Most importantly, go binge listen to Bly or Hill House, Midnight Mass or Midnight Club, because we covered all those too. And it's spooky season. It's the perfect time before Halloween. Okay, so we're finished. We know all the secrets. It's our fifth Flanagan show we've covered. I'll start with my review. So my review is that this show was really, really fun. Like, I feel like it was the first one that I was like, that was electric and fun. Midnight Club was getting there. Mm-hmm. This one was fun, and I want to watch it again without having to take notes and wait every 2 episodes to watch the next 2 after we podcast, because I just want to watch it as a casual viewer. But I think it was phenomenal. I mean, I think there's usual with Flanagan. It had a lot of great lessons to be learned about like family and life and greed and all this stuff. Also pointing out like obvious huge flaws in the system, like the pharmaceutical world or the patriarchy or the AI bullshit. All that junk. So, I mean, it was funny. It was like all this Edgar Allan Poe stuff. I was like, I feel smarter just watching this show. So it was a blast. And of course, I forgot to introduce ourselves. So I'm Kathleen. And now I'm going to let Luke, Paul, or Jimmy tell you what they think.
Let's go in that order so I can jump in next. This is Luke. I just want to say that I loved these last 2 episodes, where I was coming into these final 2 episodes to binge thinking like this was going to be a solid show overall, but these two land like the finale specifically landed mm-hmm. a lot of things I was looking for in ways that we didn't predict. Some we did, some we didn't, and most of it landed for me. So I want to say that I thought this show was really yeah. really good. But the friend of the pod Alki said this, he actually might put this up against Haunting of Hill House. That's a discussion for later at the end of the podcast. But overall, like, I expect it to like it. Like, coming into this podcast, I didn't expect to like it as much as I did, but I really, really enjoyed the ending. And this was arguably the best acted of the Flanagan verse. So that's like a feather in the cap. And I'm really excited to talk about it.
Yeah, I mean, the cast was amazing. I know one of our complaints earlier on was that the characters are so good. And like when that, like Perry or Leo, when their episode is over, we don't get too much of them anymore. But I think the rest of the cast is able to just carry like episode by episode. And yeah, you don't get them. But I mean, it was such a fun ride. Exactly what you're saying, Kathleen. And like, we kind of already knew the formula. We kind of knew it was going to happen. But how we got there was so fun to guess. And like the moments where everything just kind of clicks, it's just so well done. I loved it. Yeah, it's way up there for me. I had a, even though I watched it in the wrong freaking order.
you gang.
Yeah, it was still a lot of fun. So yeah, classic gang move.
And let me just put it out there too, because I was looking this up as you were talking. The overall rating of the show from IMDb is an 8.1, solid. Rotten Tomatoes has a 91% for critics and 75% for audience. Super solid. I think that's a success from like a peripheral point of view. So
it's always going to be tough to have your first ever show for Netflix be one of the best shows of all time.
Yeah.
We'll get into it later and we're going to put our rankings in. But like you guys said, I agree with everything. Super entertaining show. the genre was pure Flanagan, where you're just blending all these genres with horror. You're not watching a pure horror show, but you're obviously getting scared. You're getting creeped out. Going back to our Haunting of Hill House covers, there's plenty of creep counts for this show for spooky season. But this show totally shines with, like you were saying, Paul, the characters, the acting. You can just name off any character from any episode and be like, damn, that was a good acting performance. I mean, if you want to talk Mark Hamill, you want to talk Bruce Greenwood, you just go down the list. But I do think that there is something to be said about the formula. And we already kind of talked about this in the last episode, the formula of beginning to end, kind of knowing how it's going to end and just enjoying the journey will never make it, to me, an elite S tier show, just because the fact that you have that ending that blows your mind, that you've never seen coming, that's what, like, is the feather on top, or the icing on top, or feather the cap, icing on top, however you want to say the feather on top of the sundae, the cherry on top, whatever. That's what it is. And this show had plenty of amazing things that happened in the last two episodes that, like you said, Luke, we didn't see it coming. Jester, let's freaking go. Come on. That was perfect. We were worrying. You said there's no freaking way we don't get an answer. And thank gosh we did. Mm-hmm. But it was better than you could have imagined. And I know, Paul, you're freaking clapping because you called the hell out of it last episode. I just finished editing it. We dropped that episode today. And I was like, Paul just totally called that entire thing. So there you go.
Not the amazing Jester, but he got the wall.
Well, no, he got the grizz. Yeah, he got everything with the grizz. Not the Jester part, but what? Yeah, exactly.
So, I even brought up Body Artist, man. That was legitimately that.
Yeah. Seriously. No Annabelle in there, though. So I was.
That's all right.
Yeah. So let's talk about that really quick while we're here. So Annabelle's alive somewhere.
Like, she's dead.
She had a huge hole in the back of her head.
And she was young.
Were you watching that shit?
She looked a little. I was watching it on my computer half screen because I was taking notes.
Looking amazing.
Okay,
her haircut.
Okay. This is a great place to make me feel stupid. Okay, so I was staring at it, and she got a haircut. She does look a little older. She doesn't look old like fucking
60 Roger. Years older
right.
than.
Yeah, you're so right. And I was thinking that, but I was so confused. Like, what is, how does she die?
When she turns around to like touch the coffins, you see a big hole in the back of her head. And right before that, Roderick said, you know, when I took the kids after I threw the money at them, she couldn't live without the kids.
That's what I thought. Okay.
Which makes it great, because we didn't predict that. We all thought she was going to be the death instead of Griswold of that night. But
I said kill herself. But I said it because I didn't say it because he took the kids. I said it because she was disappointed in who he was.
Okay, well,
Kathleen, you had that theory that Tammy was going to kill. I'm sorry, not Tammy. Madeline was going to kill Annabelle, which I was all about, and I thought it was heading that direction. Especially, like, you know, we'll get there eventually with the trial and everything. But I was like, Kathleen called the shit out of this, and then left turn.
Okay, great. I'm way happier with that, because I'm like, Annabelle's been alive this whole time. I'm so confused. Mm-mm. It felt so real when it was happening that I was really having a moment to myself, because that's the problem with taking notes too, because I was probably ripping notes while she turned around and I missed a bullet in her head. Okay, sorry.
And I want to put one on the board for myself for bringing up the Pym and the space time thing, which I was very close to getting that right, but I was close enough where that was worth talking about.
Okay. Yes.
So let's hop into 7. Okay. This is Freddy's episode. And I think the craziest thing about the Freddy episode is, while I loved all the Freddy stuff, it really wasn't like the most important stuff. Mm-hmm. I thought it was going to be like a full Freddy front to back, but we got a lot of good stuff in this episode that didn't have really anything to do with him. But the first bucket we're going to do is like anything Augie and young Roderick. So like when they were young, any of the whistleblower stuff, any of the trial stuff, and then like the little conversation with adult Augie and Roderick about kind of heartbreaking of Augie being like, you know, I wondered all these years why I trusted you. And I figured out it was because if a woman like Annabelle could love you, then I could trust you. I'm like, yeah. That's terrible. Annabelle is the goat. She is the absolute goat. So anything in this bucket, we can just crack it wide open if you want to talk about it.
I just, in retrospect, think it is so heartbreaking. Like, Augie's story is absolutely heartbreaking. Like, knowing what Roddy does in the trial and everything, like, going back to this scene, Augie is, like, confiding in Roderick that, you know, yeah, I do have, I am lucky. I forget the exact line of what he called Annabelle, but he said, yeah, I do have a husband at home. He confided in him, probably a secret he never told anybody because it was in the middle of the 1970s.
Mm-hmm.
And he trusted him so much. And then just to have what Roddy did, it is so heartbreaking. Thought August's actor did such a good job, young and old, honestly. Mm-hmm. And I just love was this the era of like electronic toys coming out too? And that's why the siren was like the big thing just going off, or am I just
the fire truck? Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I might be making that up.
I wasn't around during that era, so I'm not sure, Paul.
Yeah.
But
they had a few of the drops like earlier on. I forget what episode it was, but Rufus had the line, you know, I'm Willy Wonka and this is my chocolate factory. I looked it up. The movie came out in like 72 or something like that, and the book came out in like 64. So the way, like, the references, it's great.
That could have been the first person to ever use that reference back then.
Maybe. Yeah.
They're like,
yeah, I made that.
I was actually, if we're just gonna talk about anything with this, you asked the question, you said we need to see where Roddy turns. And we need to see how he turns. And I was guessing that it was going to be this, but it isn't really a turn. That's the surprising thing about it. He basically explains this to Annabelle and breaks her heart. And she says to him, you've always been a POS. Like, he doesn't get convinced to turn unless it's off screen. Madeline tells him what he needs to do and he just does it. And it just seems like even his reaction to Annabelle, like, this is what I always thought I was going to do. This is who I've always been.
I'm going to say this now just because you brought this up. I really liked this show. Like, I feel like I made that obvious. I don't know if I'm on the higher side of this podcast, but I feel like I really, really liked this show. This was one of the worst parts about the show for me. And I was willing to, like, I was very open to the idea of in episode 8, there being a couple of moments for him. And there were a couple of character development moments, including the turn in the trial. And then when they actually go to the bar and talk to Verna, he's a little bit of a badass there. Like, how he's like the one that actually took a deal, which we could talk about all that stuff later. That was the only two bits that even remotely resembled modern day Roderick. So I think that as much as I love QB1, it did not sell. And I guess this is saying more about how good older Roderick is. Because I thought he was one of the standouts of the show, and I just don't think QB1 had it in him to be the OG of him. And I'm not going to harp on it, and I don't want to sound negative, because like I said, I loved it. But that was definitely something that didn't land for me, like one of two things that didn't land for me.
Let me try and convince you otherwise. So I think this whole story is a what could have been, right? Verna saying, oh, Freddie could have been a dentist, and you would have been a poet, and all this stuff, right? He would have been a poet, like a sweet angel, poor poet who like loves his wife and has two great kids. Right. So just because we don't necessarily see him turned yet. And mm-hmm. I do see a little bit of it when he's like sassing her and being like, dude, shut up. I fucking dare you to leave. Kind of like that sass.
Yeah.
I think the point of this show, especially with the kids, is like give them anything they want with no consequences and see what that turns you into. Verna made this deal and was like, you will never be caught convicted of anything. Everything will basically go your way for the rest of time. And it's like, and if that's the case, then like you are going to turn into a terrible person. Like there's mm-hmm. no consequences for your actions. You're just going to turn. And I think like just because we didn't necessarily see it in this, I don't know, maybe 2-3 month span of like what we saw in the 70s. I don't even know if you could call it that long of a span. I think that over time he becomes Roderick, especially having to be a CEO and like in the company, in the type of, you know, what am I going to say? Not company,
landscape of business.
And, yeah, like yeah. a pharmaceutical business, the market or whatever. It's the like industry, cutthroat, yeah. terrible, yeah. murdering millions of people. So I don't know. Something I agree with you, Luke, that visually what we saw, it doesn't quite compute, but there's a lot of years in there. There's 50 years in between that.
One sentence response, Jimmy, and then you go is just yeah. I agree with you. Like that is totally believable. I was just more in the opinion of show, don't tell. And I definitely did yeah. not get that.
Jimmy, one sentence and then you can go. and then one more sentence after that.
I thought you were telling me I only had one sentence. I was like, tell me, bro.
I don't know exactly what the timeline between the trial and New Year's was, but he also like went in, made out with some chick at New Year's. Like he was still, I think, married to Annabelle. Annabelle already said she wanted to like leave. I don't know exactly what that is, but there was already some scumbagginess coming out.
Yeah. So to blend what you're saying, Kathleen, and what Luke's saying, number one is I don't think this is on Zach Guilford. I don't think it's on Matt Saracen, QB1. I think it's on, sorry to say, but Flanagan. I think it's on the writing because as much of a Flanny as I am, as much of a gang as I am or whatever whatever it is, Paul, I think that the issue here is that, yes, Kathleen, you're right, where it is a tale of circumstances where Roddy could have become a poet. He would have become a poet if his life didn't take these turns with Madeline, with the Grizz, with 1979, etc. But there still has to be somewhere shown to us where he turns. Like, I'm just saying, don't even give me that.
One sentence and then you get to go, okay?
Fine, give me, no, I'm going to give you one sentence and maybe like six more and then you can
stand up for yourself. He's having his moment right now. Jimmy's turning into bad.
I'm turning into Roddy. My issue is that what I was thinking was, we have this character that we were saying young Roddy seemed like a nice guy. He's saying his poetry to Annabelle. Madeline's looking at him like, ew, what the hell are you doing? And then out of nowhere, he turns on Augie, even though, yes, we knew it was coming. We guessed it. But he turns and he does this whole monologue to Annabelle, basically being like, grow up, you know, I had to do this and get the hell out of my face. And he basically heel turned like crazy. There's no showing of why he heel turned. He basically gives us a speech saying, I was always like this. But that's not true, because Werner literally said to him, you would have been a nice little poet, just like QB1 Matt Saracen. But instead, you made the turn. Where's the turn? Why didn't we see the turn? Have a scene where Madeline talks him into it, and then he, whether he's like reluctant or whatever, but you know what I mean? It just,
yeah, I totally agree. Adult Augie had already said, you fucked me over back in the day. So it's not like it was like a surprise to us that he was going to get fucked. So I agree with you there. I'm good. I submit. Okay.
Cool. That was for Jimmy, by the way, my thumb up.
Bro, one sentence, you submit.
By saying one sentence for me is the line read from Madeline, young Madeline, our girl, saying, he did the right thing, you fucking simpleton. I was like,
oh my goodness.
Come on. That's,
I wrote that one down too. And also just to sprinkle this on top, Madeline's probably whispering in his ear this entire time, like slowly turning him from the game.
Well, that's what I'm saying. So. Show me that. I mean, I know that they are kind of showing that, but not a very, you know, there's undertones of it, but not what we were expecting.
They didn't show you
a punch in the face. Here's the heel turn.
Physically, they didn't show it to you, but like before he went into the room, Madeline comes up and is like, hey, you ready for this? Like, are you good? And he nods. Yeah. Like they planned on it all before. So I know they didn't show it. Yeah, whatever.
Don't need to beat a dead horse here. But my thing would be that if he was talked into it by Madeline and he wasn't always a POS, he would have talked to Annabelle and would have been like, I told you not to come, which he did say. And I'm sorry I did that, but I just had to. Like, he would have been nice about it. He would have been like, I didn't think it was the right thing to do, but it's what I had to do. Instead, he basically nailed her like Maddie did. And it was just not what we would have expected.
And I'm happy because that's the biggest complaint I have for the season, probably. So I'm already off the board of negativity, cool. I think. Yeah.
All right. Let's keep it rocking. So two little quick scenes with mostly Roderick losing it over Tam. This is like the only time we hear of like Tam's death, really. It's kind of like, all right, see you later. Doesn't matter. And he's upset about like Juno getting fucking smacked in the head with the thing. But Madeline tells him like, okay, Verna disappeared in my hands. And Roderick's like, go fuck yourself. You're out of your mind. That's not true. And then the key thing here is Freddie is the swing vote. Okay. Mm-hmm. So this is going to like kick off Freddie's timeline. But first, just Madeline and Pim talking about kind of kicking Roddy out and having her step in as CEO. You know, she wants to take it out of pills and pharma and go into AI and tech. And she wants to be, you know, top dog. So anything there, or should we just rock into Freddy stuff?
I have a note here too that Maddie claims that she loves Rod here again, right? And like, that's just, doesn't she say something where she's like, I do care about him or something like that?
Arthur's saying like Rod is a great man. Like Pam is like defending him when they're having that conversation. I think Madeline says like, yeah, like I do love him.
Okay. Yeah. Just, I wanted to bring that up because we're going to talk about it later of like, did she actually care about him or not? So,
okay.
Quick side note. I'll be really quick. We find out that Freddy is a swing vote. We know that Vic was also a member of the shareholders, or she was a shareholder. And I'm guessing Tam would have been too. So my question to you guys is, do you think that's why Camille hated Vic? Because they don't really give us that reason. She hated Vic so much.
Yeah, true.
There was this small reason that she was better at hiding it. Like, that was really it.
Verna. But, that's what Verna says. But yeah.
And Verna knows all, though.
Yeah, she does know all, so that's fine.
All right. Okay, let's hop into the Freddy thing, man. Our boy was off his fucking rocker in this episode. We open with him posting pictures all over the wall of him and her. Fucking crazy, like a true psycho. This is like getting into some like horror shit. The story about the day they met, about him being, you know, like lonely all the time, and then she came up to him being like, you could look like you could use a friend. And then like being like ruthless or toothless, and then him ripping her teeth out, and he would have been a dentist. It was all really good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, let's open the board all the way until, you know, the Lenore stuff. If we want, we can any Frederick stuff, because this is our sayonara to Frederick.
Loved it. Him just sniffing in between every sentence because of all the coke that he's snorting is just so good. I know, just a little tweet. Details here and there. So question for you guys, because I did not know how to take this. He learns from Roderick that he is the swing vote. They didn't even call him yet. He says, when they call you, don't answer. So they call him in the next scene and he answers.
Yeah.
Do you think he was going to be the swing vote and try to take over the company from Roderick?
Oh, yeah.
Bro? What? Wait, wait, wait. You think he was?
Okay.
Yeah. He was big dick in it, I thought. Yeah.
That's what I thought he was. He was high on coke.
I missed all of that.
Yeah.
I'm the heir. Like, I'm taking over.
I don't have the quote written down, and I should. And it's the quote that Roderick tells him to tell any of the shareholders if they call. He reverses that quote and basically uses it against Roddy when he's talking to the shareholders. And yeah, he's basically saying, you know, I'm taking over.
I like that. I don't know how I missed that. There's my miss, Kathleen. You missed the Annabelle death. I missed
mine
that.
Mine was a little more obvious.
Now, like Freddy's interesting because earlier, Fredzo. I think it was like episode 5, he had a line where he's like looking over his wife on the hospital bed saying like, it just shows to go you. And like, he flopped the go and you know what I'm talking about. And like, I don't know if he was just doing that. Like, they kept it on there because it just shows that he's a complete idiot and like it was an accident and they were just like, fucking keep it. Or if like it was scripted, but he's such an idiot. I couldn't tell on the phone if he was just flopping that because he's stupid or if he's like, so, yo, I'm taking over Fortunato. Like, I'm the guy now. So the fact that he was feeling confident for the first time, wasn't just sucking up to his dad, kind of interesting. But right when that confidence gets up is immediately he falls down. And just quickly, I love that Verna is just right there the whole time. And she's like, usually I don't get this involved, but you had to reach for the pliers. And I was like, oh, why did you?
I'll jump in. Henry Thomas, man, he has a special place in Bingetown Heart. We've talked to him and he is like the nicest. And I said it earlier in this podcast season of this show, like he needs to get into comedies. He's so freaking good. Yeah. Like his beats, his delivery. He's just a hilarious presence on screen. And with that being said, this was like from episode 1/2. Like once we really got to know the family, this is like the plot route that I was so shocked by. I never in a million years would have thought that we would have got to the point where he's torturing his wife and ripping her teeth out and he's just high on coke. Like all of this was a wild turn and it was a joy to see. And I do like it a lot in this episode because we were saying earlier in the podcast that it was a little bit boring, not boring, but the structure was getting repetitive.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. They didn't do that much of the same structure here until the end, because they did so much groundwork subtly throughout the season that they didn't have to waste all that time making it feel like the same thing. And we get to look at bigger picture stuff, which is why I think this episode hit better than the other kids' individual episodes for me. But he was a joy in the little bit of time he got. And just looking at my notes, he was like, besides the ending, he was barely in this episode.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Yeah, so let me jump in, because we got like insane insight on how the kids grew up with Roderick. So the two lessons were, one, if you want to test a bond, you don't need to break it, you just crack it a little. Second lesson was getting the house in order. You don't have to be a tyrant, but if you don't want to be consistently cruel, then you have to be sufficiently brutal at least once. So these kids grew up in just like a... like, I couldn't even fucking imagine. Like, if that's the motto of your house, that your kids are regurgitating it, like, you're fucked up. And this was a huge Lenore episode and, like, turning point. We knew Lenore was going to be important. And her, like, breaking the mold of being like, fuck you, Pim. I'm absolutely not going with your bullshit, you fucking ghoul. When she called him a ghoul, I was like, yes, bitch, let's go. And I was so pumped, because the whole time I was like, they're in the other room. Where is Lenore at? Did they send her to boarding school? She's just right in the other room. I don't understand. So I was glad that they showed like the door was locked and that she just busted through and was like, what the actual fuck? But I thought that was all excellent. And then, of course, the death was phenomenal. And I did see a tweet where like they opened the episode with that little cat clock with the like moving pendulum. And then he dies with a pendulum, which was hot. And cool. And her laying down next to him.
Yeah. Gosh. This is a Carla Gugino two episodes too, man. She was good.
In her bag, bro.
Yeah, but let's continue giving Henry Thomas his flowers, because like you said, he's gonna be swan songing pretty soon. So like you were saying, Luke, he's just got the range. And let's just talk about Flanagan shows. We don't have to talk about prior movies he's been in or anything like that. He's acting like a druggie with the coke. He's acting deranged. He's hilarious with the bowling and other things like that. Dramatic in Hill House, pompous when he's in Bly. There's just so many different versions of Henry Thomas and what genre he can play. It's just amazing. And I feel like I'm so happy that we started watching Flanagan and it brought Henry Thomas back to our screens again, because I hadn't seen him in a long time.
Yeah.
And anything. And he's been in plenty, but I just hadn't seen him. And now I pretty much get to consistently see him yearly, and it's a pleasure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, rest in peace, fuckface, with his little dick out. Not little, sorry, Henry, if you're listening. I didn't mean to say that.
This was of course he had to go in just to piss on Perry's like death spot. So ridiculous. He totally could have avoided this if he didn't want to do that.
And but, it's just how every single one of these are.
You like called that out earlier this season, Jimmy, and that was good, because Verna says like you guys all could have gone nicely, but she basically gave him all the chance.
Here you are. And also, I don't know a whole lot about Edgar Allan Poe, but I don't even know for a fact if this is his writing, but I know that The Simpsons spoofed it in one of an Edgar Allan Poe's episodes. So like the swinging guillotine, that's like iconic Poe, I'm pretty sure.
And that's hitting the pendulum.
And same with, going behind the wall just to go to the finale. So he does this a lot, and he really, with Midnight Club, when Flanagan gave us the breakdown of what was going to happen in the seasons to come that got canceled, he literally quotes the source of where he got the inspiration from and follows through with it. So I love how he's bringing this old material that's still, it's good for a reason, and it stood the test of time for the reason, and he's bringing it back and putting it in such a new style and fashion. It's kind of like an ode to those that came before him, and he's just like moving it, paying it forward. So I just love the way he tells stories, man. I've fallen in love with him.
Beautiful.
Agreed. And while we're here, you guys don't know this. I'm going to do this live. We got an email from a fan.
I know. I don't know this.
Oh, maybe. Did you check out our email, Kathleen? We got an email from a fan, and she's talking about Edgar Allan Poe. So let's just read it really quick. So this is from Laura. Hello, my name is Laura, and I've listened to your podcast on the fall of the House of Usher. I've been a Poe fan since childhood. I know these stories and poems, so I'm loving how this show has paid so much love to Poe. I'm not sure if you guys have yet caught all the references to his stories, though. Even the names are Poe's. Each episode is directly from the Poe stories. The Black Cat is a very important episode. Murder in the Rue Morgue was about a rough ape killing. To me, this series is pure perfection and a love letter to the great Poe himself. Thank you for listening to me, Laura. So, yeah, I said this in episode one. I knew that it was going to be referencing Poe, and we've talked about it throughout our podcast episodes, but I specifically didn't research as much as I wanted to. I didn't do any research on any of the stories because I didn't want to accidentally figure out any kind of spoilers. I don't know anything about how the Fall of House of Usher ends. I do now because I looked into it after watching the finale, and I'm glad that I didn't look into it because it is kind of telling of how the end of the show is. So yeah, Laura, we really appreciate that. We've caught some surface level stuff, but there's plenty that we missed. I didn't know about the ape. I didn't know the Black Cat was a big deal. Like I said, it's pretty surface level what I do know.
Mm-hmm. I love that, man. I was kind of craving more content about the Poe stuff, which we're not poets. We don't know shit about that territory.
Right.
So that's a great informational email in there, because Alki was even saying he didn't know how much was actually pulled from Poe besides symbolism and a couple of poems here and there, but it seems deeper than that. And I love that. But I want to say one more thing about this final scene with Freddie, because we're going to walk away from the Freddie stuff. But I want to say a thing about Verna real quick, because we already mentioned it, her personality comes out so much more as like the devil in these two episodes. And I fucking loved the little switch on where she starts being charismatic and like being involved more. And she even says here that she never gets as involved as she did with Freddie's death when she basically had that weird moment, which I noticed earlier, but didn't even take a note on.
Yes, like that's what I was going to ask.
He caught himself on the phone, and we find out that it was Verna. Makes that even better. But I do love that she got so directly involved and basically caused him to take the nightshade, which we've been saying since I brought it up on episode one when they mentioned it, that the nightshade was going to be directly involved with a death. And this was like perfect.
Fuck yeah.
The kill was so well done cinematically.
And he felt it all too.
Symbolically, and he felt it all, yes.
Yeah.
I even loved where, like you said, Luke, Verna gets involved. You see her show up behind, but then you see Maury watching him accidentally putting the wrong powder into his Coke.
Sexy.
Whatever. His Coke pouch or whatever. Yeah. So yeah, it was so good.
Verna in a hard hat. Talk about sexy. I was like, ooh.
Hot mama. Okay, yeah. Freddie, we love you, our guy. You turned out to be a psycho, and it was pretty good. Okay, next we're gonna talk more noises in the basement before we jump into Madeline going to the new house, the old house, sorry. So Lenore calls again. Every time Lenore calls, there's like a noise in the basement. It's just how it goes. And Augie is just fed up with the bullshit. Roddy says, "You got me dead on rights for murder." Like, which we now find out is Madeline, I assume he meant. Not like I thought when we saw the Lenore thing later, I thought he meant her, because that was the body in the house. But then, of course, I mean, Madeline's just like, what did he think when he was hearing all that stuff in the basement? Like, I don't understand what he think.
He's just crazy. He was losing it. Also, yeah, I think when he said murder, I think he was originally talking about Rufus, and then he was like, two, actually, and then referring to Matt.
Okay, all right, so the original was Rufus. All right, cool. They'd have to knock down the wall and see him. Like, to see a skeleton in that fucking jester outfit.
That's hilarious. Terrifying.
Okay, we get the clock chimes, and he says it's probably Freddie micromanaging like the rest of the kids have, which I thought was like so funny. And then we just get Annabelle and baby Freddie showing up. And of course, the scare of Freddie getting chopped in half, basically, which was foreshadowing to his death, because I don't think we had seen it at this point, but maybe we already did. I'm not sure because my notes are bucketed. But anything before we jump into the Madeline scenes?
That should have been the telltale sign, Kathleen, that Annabelle was dead.
100%. Like, and I was thinking that because I'm like, oh, that was before we get the Annabelle stuff with the bullet in her head, right? Mm-hmm. So I was like, okay, good, confirmed. Annabelle's dead. Like, we've only seen dead people come back. Like, we haven't seen anyone from his past that isn't dead come back. 100% was just stupid. Stupid. Okay, so opening the floor for our girl Madeline going toe-to-toe with Verna, the two baddest bitches in the fucking universe, and outside of time and space and inside of time and space, these two can go toe-to-toe. And Laura, I'm sure you absolutely adored Verna's telling of the city and the sea, which is one of his like big poems, Edgar Allan Poe's big poems. Fucking phenomenal. Boys, take it away.
So good, man. When she started stepping in there and she started talking to Verna like she knew her, like what was going down, she's like, let's talk terms, I want a new deal, I was losing my shit. I was like, this is so cool. I mean, we were kind of talking about it, we were flirting with it, tiptoeing around what it really was, like the whole thing, but you know, deal with the devil is pretty much, you know, it could be the answer for all we got. So really cool. I love the line, you know, have a seat. Like, these aren't for us. These are for the boys later.
Yes.
Oh, my God. So good. And then she called her, you know, my Cleopatra. Again, just going into the whole immortality, the pharaohs, the whole thing. Like you said, the two powerful, most powerful women in the show just clashing heads. It was great.
Mm-hmm. I thought both Madelines were, if we were doing MVP for a podcast, Madeline, the character, would win it collectively from both of them, especially the younger Madeline got a lot of screen time and I loved her, but older Madeline like changed my whole opinion on her in these two episodes. And I love that she tries to change the word pack with the devil. Like she says, like, you know, I'm not a human. And then the way Madeline tries to dance around it, Verna says, so you're blaming Roderick or rhetoric? And it's just like such a perfect way to say that. Because like you could feel the tension, and it was probably predictable to 90% of the audience by this point that it was a deal with the devil or Mephisto or a demon, whatever you want to say. I don't know if she ever said she's the devil itself. Mm-hmm. But even with all of that being predictable, it landed in a perfect way that this reveal, even though Jimmy nailed it after two episodes, like was still so satisfying because there was nothing like writing wise wrong with it. And this just really went to elevate both Verna and Madeline as just great presence in the show.
Two great actresses, toe to toe. Carla Gugino, I had to tweet that she's the GOAT. And I don't think I said the GOAT because I feel like everyone uses that too much, but I said something like she's so freaking good. Well, I don't remember what I said, but GOAT is greatest of all time. You're only supposed to have one. And I think I say GOAT every other sentence, but she's phenomenal. I couldn't get enough of these two episodes. We talked about how, I think I specifically said it in our second podcast, where I was worried that Verna, AKA Carla Gugino, was only going to be like undertoned as a character in the background of the show. And I was worried because, you know, Haunting of Hill House, we get Carla Gugino. The other ones, she's not a main character. We're not seeing her all the time. Obviously, she's in Gerald's Game with our boy Bruce Greenwood. But for the Flanagan shows, we haven't really gotten her highlighted since Hill House. So the fact that we got her for Usher, so satisfying. And this scene specifically, both of them just like flexing their acting chops. Great scene. So fun.
Yeah, Flanagan was like fucking around in these episodes. He was absolutely having a ball. I mean, if you're like I'm assuming this because I am not a woman of the arts. Podcasting is as far as I get into the creativeness. But like, if you are an Edgar Allan Poe fan and you get to like have this character do the city and the sea, which is obviously like Verna says, years ago, I offered you certainty, tonight, clarity, no strings, right? And then he gets to go into all this post stuff. We get great scenes flashing in between. And the stuff beforehand was so fucking good. Like, she wants to renegotiate. She's saying, words got us into it. Words can get us out. Madeline is like a fucking businesswoman, right? She gets shit done. She's like, I don't care that you're like a fictional being, basically. I don't care. We're going to negotiate this. It was fucking awesome.
She snaps her neck.
Yeah. No one snaps a neck like Madeline. That was the easiest neck snap I've ever seen. She uses like her fingertips, basically. Yeah.
She's incredible. Like, I apologize. Sorry about that.
No hesitation, too.
Yeah. And so, I mean, Mike was just absolutely crushing it. Like, my last one from him is, you're a collection of impeccable, elaborate masks in an orbit of a stunted heart. Like, come on. You're kidding. You're kidding. Mm-hmm. This fucking guy.
That's what caused the next that line.
Yeah, literally. The only thing I have to say about this is that this is when I started questioning, because in 5-6, we had said we were happy that Madeline didn't know she made a deal with the devil. But it, and then I was like, she wants to renegotiate. She obviously knows she made a deal. But I like in episode 8, they clarify that it kind of becomes fuzzy and they were misremembering it. And it became something where they were like, huh, like a delusion shared by two people. So at least like they remember it happened, but they were like, was that real?
If that didn't happen, I'd throw this whole show in the trash. Like, that was the literal saving grace of like the whole thing. Yeah. If that didn't, you know, I feel like we all would have been shitting on it, because like, you make a deal with the devil, you have that kind of night, you remember it. So that saved almost everything, even with Pym too.
Yeah. And I take it like Perry's kill, his murder, where all the workers that were innocent were told to leave, but they couldn't really remember that they were specifically told to leave.
100%.
It was just like this feeling in the back of their head. Like, I feel like I was told I need to leave, so I left.
That's great connection.
Love that. Okay. Next, Juno. Our girl Juno, who ends up, let's just say it, on top. On fucking top, baby.
Love
She's
it,
the
man.
Queen.
She's the winner.
So Juno, we find out, is on 2,000 milligrams, and she wants, and the doc wants to up it after she gets doinked in the head with the fucking microphone. So she is teeing up the conversation she has with Roddy that she wants to wean herself off, right? And Roderick's like, go fuck yourself. Absolutely not. He does this incredible, incredible spiel about, like, no, it's not addictive. But and then names every symptom of coming down of after getting well, as Luke would say, getting down off of a drug, which is so funny. Like, everything is so like PC, not PC, definitely not PC. Like, you know,
legal.
Business washed. You know what I mean?
Legal,
like, you
disclaimer.
Would never say anything. Yes. Yeah. Thank you. I don't know. My brain's not working.
No, it was so good. Absolutely amazing. When she goes, I married a monster. And he goes, no, I'm Victor Frankenstein. You are the monster. Like, this perfect creation.
Incredible.
You are a miracle. Your body just soaks up the ligodone. My drug is water and you're the flower. I was like, oh, my God. I would be bawling crying if I were her. Good for her to be able to stand up and look him in the eye. So I think he genuinely did love Juno, just not in the love sense. He loved that she existed, and there was a heroin addict that was able to just take milligrams and milligrams and milligrams of this drug.
Yeah, Rod slays, and I'm putting it on the board now. Like, he's up there with Father Paul of Midnight Mass, and just like in non-main Flanagan castmate performances. That makes sense. Like, not the reoccurring characters, but one of the characters that just shows up and just slays in acting. And he was, every single time he gives like even a mini monologue, it's just gripping and so well written and just so well acted, which brings me back to what we brought up last podcast. How was everything reshot? How was the show going to be without him? Like, there's no way that it would have been as good.
Well, I had seen Raul post something today. He was posting basically what he did. You know, the actor strike is still happening. So what he did was he posted each of his castmates of Fall of the House of Usher from a different role. Like, he posted, you know, call it Greenwood in National
Charles
Treasure.
Gamer,
he didn't, but no, like different things, just like all different things when they were young or whatever, to kind of be like, these are my people. This is me celebrating it without actually posting like a poster for Fall of the House of Usher. But then he said, like, because this was shooting or about to shoot soon when we were interviewing Henry Thomas, which was in 2021, right? So they were in still heavy COVID protocols. Like, he posted, like, all these people, like, crew, everyone had to miss their families for 6 to 7 months because you were isolated. You had to quarantine. You couldn't, like, go back and forth to home. Everyone was in, like, insane things. So, like, I guess people were giving him shit for posting those different ones, like, pictures, like, as a loophole. But he's like, I'm just trying to give props. Like, I love this cast. They did an incredible job, like, blah, blah, blah. So, I mean, like, just... Yeah. fucking phenomenal acting all around. It was a 10 out of 10.
Yeah, he was saying, like, you're not supposed to promote any of the works that recently came out now because of the strike, and they'll still give him money or whatever. So he was just trying to respect the whole crew and everything. And he's the man. I saw that post, Raul Coley. I think, Jimmy, you said this earlier, he is hysterical outside of
the show, too.
He's so funny.
He's a savage. He really is.
I do want to say, I was editing the last episode, and you had Justice for Juno as a slogan, and I love it. Justice for Juno.
She got
her justice. Yeah.
She did.
She's probably who you want to be, I guess.
I mean,
maybe not.
How much
rough
did
path
we...
there.
In episode one, coverage of Midnight Club, episode one and two, I literally said, who's your favorite character and why is it Anya? Like, I love Ruth Codd. She is that bitch. She's so good. All the women on this show are fucking tens. Okay, let's rip through episode seven. This is the last scene. So it's Madeline visiting Roderick in the basement. And I don't know why they thought this would work. and he just goes along with it. She's like, all right, like, the deal was we came into this world together. We got to go out. So I'm going to fucking kill you right now. So take these, you know, 10, 5 at a time. You got to take them fast, like all this stuff. Mm-hmm. And then I'm going to bring this back because if you remember in Hill House and Bly, I'm pretty sure we did like boops and bops or whatever, like Bly when they would go in and out and touching each other to like go in and out of each other. And then in Hill House when Poppy would like pop people in and out of their like dreamlight state. She does this to Roderick, which was incredible. And then he's like wakes up and pukes everywhere and is alive. And I was like, I love that. That feels like a callback.
The cinematography of it was amazing. Like it was just dead silent and it just stayed there for so long. You knew it was coming. And then I really love that moment. But also shout out to Jimmy. The clanging wasn't the bells, it was the shackles, right?
Well, both.
It's the handcuffs. Right.
Yeah, it's the handcuffs, and he had the bell on his head, so I'm assuming...
Right, it could be both, yeah. But they do say the subtitles, like, metallic clanging, a lot. At least in this episode. I don't know about the first one, but...
It means a lot that you gave me those props, Luke.
Yeah, James.
I mean, this goes back to... however many episodes ago it was when Roderick was trying to kill himself. He was trying to work up the courage, as he said, to go through with it. And he was thinking of all those ways. He was like, I know there's only one way to stop it and I can do it. So it's wild that he does it now when there's only literally Madeline left, because she comes in and says, like, you know, Freddie's dead. Like that's it. There's only, I guess it would be saving Lenore too. So that was definitely another reason why Roderick might have actually made the sacrifice. But when he's downing them and she goes, that's a legend. That's a king. You're saving us all. I was fucking cracking up and I was like, fucking, I will take those pills if you sell me that, Madeline. That was so good, man.
And he does it right back to her in the next episode when he's like, you're queen.
A goddess.
I love that too. Any thoughts on seven before we jump in? The only thing I will say, and it'll lead us right into seven, is I don't think they understood that Lenore was next. I don't think they thought Lenore was fair game. I think they thought it was kids. And then when she's on the bed being like, man, I don't know what they thought I was saying when I said bloodline, but bitches, it's bloodline.
That was a great line read.
Luke, to go off what you were saying earlier about did Madeline really love Roderick or not, at the very end, when he's like finishing the bottle, she like kind of like smirks, and like the way she like plants everything on him and walks away. I'm like, I honestly don't know. I'm like, is she just like so emotionally detached and she just doesn't like show it? I don't know. I couldn't tell.
No, I got a little bit of that too, which is part of the reason I questioned it. And then also this next scene that we're going to talk about after Rod gets up and throws up and he talks to Pim in the boardroom with Madeline, it seems like it was all a board play, right? Like it was a succession kind of move. There's so much that I still am not convinced one way or the other if they loved each other. Like, I know it seems more likely that he loved her, but again, we can talk about this more at the end after the kill, but a lot goes back and forth. I don't know. I really can't get a good read on Madeline.
I'm still sticking with my guns here. I think she cares, but I think she cares marginally about him compared to herself and her eternity, like her being immortal and the Usher name and business. She literally has him kill himself so that she can, one, break the contract, she thinks, so she can stay alive, and two, then he's gone so she can take over.
Mm-hmm.
If she cared about him, she would be like, spoiler alert, we made this deal together. Let's die together. I will take these pills with you.
Yeah.
Hug it out and die.
So,
and that would have saved Lenore, by the way.
If they're thinking that Lenore's a... Yeah.
I hate to jump ahead, but do you think Madeline was still like rustling around down there because she couldn't die without him dying with her? Like, is that why she was still alive? Even with like a knife through her chest or whatever the fuck he did? Like...
Ripped her eyes out. We already kind of alluded to this. It's freaking insane that he's down. He's upstairs hearing her moving. Why isn't he being like, why the hell is she moving? I just ripped her eyes out and I killed her. I thought she was given the same poison, either that you could say it's the nightshade, which it isn't because she's moving. So we can assume it might be the same poison that the Riz gets, something like that. The cyanide that keeps him like, he's allowed to move and stuff, but he will eventually die from it. He's just chilling. There's no reason to be so calm when he's talking to Augie and being like, yeah, that's Madeline down there. Could there's no reason for her to really be moving. She should be dead. True. He ripped her eyes out. He freaking killed her.
It could be the dementia, why he's like not even worried about her, the sound of her and everything like that. Like the actual dementia.
He could think she's dead and he's just hearing her now that she's dead, like he hears his kids, but then again, Augie shouldn't hear it, but whatever.
Yeah. I also thought he used the nightshade and not the cyanide. So the nightshade eventually it wears off and you get it back. And I mean, if all he did was pluck out of her eyes, then you know, she wouldn't be dead.
He stabs her ass. He gets a knife. Unless he gets the eyes. Yeah, true.
Plucks it out.
True, true, true. Yeah, it's hard to tell.
I think that it, again, I don't know if we want to talk about it yet, but I think it was the cyanide to kill her and then rip the eyes out, and everything down there is their crypt, their coffin, their sarcophagus, whatever you want to say, because they're Egyptian god and goddesses. But it could have been either.
Well, it was also super poetic because when Madeline finally tells Pim to go get this girl that they're talking about, she's like, I want her eyes. Bring me her eyes. Like, that's how I know. And at
good
the callback.
End, hey, I brought that.
Popped
I brought
out.
That up last episode.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, it ties into
connecting
this.
Connecting it to this.
Just saying, like, literally missing out.
Some props.
Kathleen, you brought this up last episode, but her eyes, she was saying, bring me her eyes.
Hey, I have one sentence, okay? And then you're going to keep going. Okay, so quickly, Verna like reads him for filth and is like, you don't get to die. You've killed millions of jillions of people. And that's just people who have died. Many more, just as many are as addictive, ruined. Like, your tally is fucking impressive, you know? So that happens. Opening bell. We're going. She has a few more transactions left. We already talked about Pim showing up to, you know, clean up the Lenore situation, but she doesn't stand for it. We also get that the board is going to boot Roderick for Maddie. So, you know, Freddie's dead, so it's whatever. But so Roddy's done. And then we get some details on Annabelle. So Roderick said Annabelle had custody and he couldn't stand it. So when they were older, he bombed them with money. He choked out all the Annabelle in them. So anything that was good, all the Annabelle that Lenore has, he ripped it all out. And apparently this is when she kills herself, which I didn't understand. But now I really do understand it. But anything about Annabelle that you want to talk about? Because this is kind of her swan song as well.
Heartbreaking.
Do good for Roddy.
Yeah.
Do you imagine being Annabelle, like just being her and you just married the wrong guy and all of a sudden now your kids are gone?
Yep. The last thing I'll say is I've been seeing some comparisons of Poppy from Hill House. You know how she was with that like flapper. She wore the thing on her head like in the green, almost exactly like Madeline's dressed up on New Year's. And I've seen some parallels. They do look great. Like it is almost like a callback. And when I saw that before watching 7 and 8, I was like, oh, shit, it's a Halloween party. That's where the jester's going to come. And I was like, wait, no, it's not. Never mind. And then just never thought about it again. Like, I didn't think it was going to be Rufus, but I did think Jester when I saw that tweet. And I was like, oh, it's a Halloween party. We should have called that. And I was
But it's not Halloween.
I know.
It's a Halloween themed New Year's Eve party. I don't know. Costume party, whatever.
I like it.
True. That's even, we would not have guessed that.
All right, let's get there. It is the New Year's Halloween party, and it's a fucking blast. Rufus is like absolutely patting our guy on the back and our girl. They're partying. Rufus is like hyping this guy the fuck up. Meanwhile, our kids had a more nefarious plan in place. Now, open book all the way until the brick by brick. So let's just rock it. Go ahead.
Only thing really that I have that I was cracking up at is when Roderick walks away after they give Rufus the wine. He's like, oh, I got to go to the bathroom. And some dude walks up to him and is like, hey, you're my hero. Dude's just in just like a Jaws costume because it like just came out. Like he's getting eaten by a shark.
I thought you were going to say when Madeline licks Rufus's ear. That's why I did that just now. I didn't want to be creepy. I just thought that's what you were going to say.
No, but her seduction, I'm like, Rufus, it would have worked on me. Sorry, Rufus. I mean, I get it.
This is part of the scenes I was talking about earlier when I said she really just like shot up in the ranks of characters because she got so much screen time here and she was just charismatic and great at running the plan, conning him. And Jimmy, I feel like you did your ears perk up when you heard what do we call Rizzy Grizzy Grizz? What do you call him?
He calls him the Grizz. He calls him Grizz when they're talking. So it's Rufy Grizz, but he does say Grizz when he's talking to Augie later. Like he actually calls him Grizz.
I fucking love that. Paul kind of halfway got there. But
you're saying they gave him a roofie?
No. What I was saying was that when he walks up to Roderick and says he calls him a made man, I just instantly thought of Sopranos. Like, isn't that a thing?
Oh, yeah.
He's you're a made man. Like, you don't have to worry about anything anymore. I'm like, Alki probably loved that.
But this whole scene, like the mob.
Yeah, exactly. And that's pretty much what he was getting into. He would have probably been fine if they didn't kill Griswold. But this was just like the most brutal death ever. Luckily,
incredible.
They save it by saying that when he falls asleep, he's not going to wake up. Because I thought it was the whole Bodyatus thing where he's just going to sit there for 3 days until he has no water and dies. Which in the darkness, horrible. Like I couldn't even imagine that level of death. That's the equivalent of waking up buried underground. So.
Mm-hmm.
At least they were a little bit sympathetic and not just like super heartless killers.
Yeah.
Because I was thinking about, if you're really desperate, couldn't you like rip off like basically your arm, like your hand, like slip them out of there? But the fact that they had that, cyanide in there, that would really kill them.
And you're behind a wall. It's still soft maybe for a certain amount of time. Just like how they were amateurs burying their mom alive, but they're not amateurs. They're
fucking professional masons the way they're putting
them to the practice
while having a full conversation. They're fully just laying brick with no problem.
You're not spreading the grout over the front face at all. Like, you guys are amazing.
I literally have a note being like, what happens when the workers come back and they're like, who finished this wall? And if this shit up to code, we gotta knock this down and start over.
He would know.
So. Yeah, I did like how that guy kind of like stood back a little bit, and the grout from all the up top of the wall was still dark and wet compared to the white grout down below. So
nice
continuity thing.
And why do I? If you have a comment, go ahead on this.
Oh, okay. So a couple things. I loved Madeline just owning him about the sherry a couple times, mm-hmm. like just being like, "This guy doesn't know dick about sherry, man. Like, fuck this loser." And then two is the "you're so small" brick. I just wanted to bring it up because that's what. Annabelle said to her in a previous episode, and then she brought it back and wrote that on a thing, which I liked.
What was that, like her getting over the criticism, or like what was the, I didn't get that out of the symbolism of it.
I felt like that comment by Annabelle hurt Madeline, even though she didn't show it actually hit her to the core. So she was like, hey, I'm gonna use this on fucking Rufy Grizz, and because it's definitely gonna hurt him. And I guess
get over it a little bit, right? Is that my region? I don't know.
I think it was. I think it was earned. It wasn't just like the Madeline Rufus conversation from the previous episode when she goes to his office is like more brutal than we made it out to be on the pod. Like he's like treating her like a, like she's nothing. And so like she wanted nothing more than to prove that he is nothing and he is small. You know what I mean? So I think it was just like, you know, I think the Annabelle thing is separate, but I think it really is a transfer of that diss. Like, it's what? Like, you know what? I'm going to use this.
I think later back when Madeline, young Madeline, does go into Rufus Griswold's office, I think he does say, like, you are so small, when he is like trying to attack her or something like that. So maybe that was just another callback from that. But also, was the only reason the candle was in there so that he could read the inside of that brick?
Maybe. Or
give
maybe
him a little
just
bit
like,
of light to torment him.
Yeah, to read.
Yeah, slowly go out.
It's funny that you guys brought up the Annabelle thing, and I'm glad you did, because that slipped my mind. For some reason, I was thinking that he said that to her and she's getting back at him for saying it to her. But I don't know if that's even right. Paul, you said maybe that happened. I can't remember, but that's what popped into my head.
Yeah.
Also, fucking hysterical when he's like, come on, I'll give you whatever you want, 3 million. But you could be whoever you want in the company. And she was like, I was thinking COO. And he was like, yeah, well, fuck. I mean, okay. Like,
not good goal. That's a good long-term goal.
Yeah, good goal. Good goal.
Why is my final note for this scene? It just says clean transition to Verna's bar. Is there like a cool, I forget, I can't remember how we, maybe it's like a cinematography thing and I didn't write enough details down to know why. Does she like take a swig and then puts it down? It's like,
it's Madeline telling a story. So I don't know how it might be the glass coming down, but
something like that.
It is like Madeline telling a story and then they come to it was the also table with the three of them.
Madeline, when they're in the basement, after they say, you know, I thought he would be louder, they're like, all right, what do we do? Go back upstairs, be seen? She's like, nah, let's just get away, go to a bar, maybe somewhere small, low key, off the map, and then pop.
And then just like, off the
map. They really found one off the map.
Yeah. Off the map. Outside of space and time, baby. Let's go to Mars.
All right. Dude. So we're at the bar, right? And they're talking deal breakers. And then she offers them, okay, like, a lifetime of comfort, basically. What would you give up? She calls them a couple of killers and all this stuff. And then as soon as she brings up Rufus, this is when I would start being like, there's just no way you could know this. Mm-hmm. So like the fact that they were like thinking like, man, this woman's like a trip. Like, she, what a weird gal. It's like, you, neither of you are going to make like, this woman just called you out for killing someone. You're not going to make a bigger deal out of this.
Yeah, right.
I feel like that helped lean into the fact that, like, oh shit, she might like not just be making up a hypothetical. This might be a real deal. Like, if she knows something that nobody else knows about, maybe she is this like all other power. But then the whole memory thing comes into it. So that's why they didn't like freak out afterwards, I guess, or something.
This scene is entirely just wild. I mean, it really is outside of space and time. It's almost like, I'm like mixing some of our shows together, but like Gen V with like pheromones, it's like something's in the air where they're kind of like high and they're just like, they're allowing things to be said where it's not freaking them out too much. But you can see their faces are very telling when she does say, like, just like you killed Rufus, like they realize it, but they're not really, they're only taking it like Maddie. She's doing the logical understanding the seriousness of it. She's not outwardly showing like she's, oh, I'm freaking out, man. Like, it starts off with, I like you, but you're crazy. It's like one of those things where it's like, yeah, oh, this girl, she's cool, but she's a weirdo, dude. Like, but then when she starts saying the things that are very like, how the hell do you know that? Then it's almost like, all right, Madeline's getting into like brass tacks here. She's like, so what are we talking here? Like, what are the terms, this and that? And I wasn't expecting Roddy to be the one that says, I'm in first.
The one bullies. He's the fucking one.
He has kids. He has kids. Yes, he already has the two. Maddie does not have any kids. And he is like, oh, obviously I'm in.
Mm-hmm.
Annabelle had just left him and he's ready to rock and roll. Like, he's like, yeah, I got nothing left to lose. Let's go.
Yeah. I guess like coming from, they say like rags to riches the whole time too, like coming from the bottom, I guess he's like, fuck, man. Because she makes the point, what's better, 50 years of, you know, living it up versus 80 years of anxiety? Mm-hmm. You know, she made it super appealing. They're drunk, they're wasted.
Yo,
you know,
give so me, I say yes to that deal right now. Stop. Yeah. I stop.
The whole idea.
I know you
of,
say yes to that, Lukey.
Fuck yeah. Hit that button right now.
The next generation foots the bill.
Morally gray. That's our Luke.
I was thinking the same thing. I was like, dude, I could just see Luke just being like, dude, you struck oil. Stop drilling, dude. Like,
dude, yeah. And then they keep gassing it up more and more. You're never going to lose a single lawsuit. I'm like, dude, just fucking stop.
How about fucking Maddie, though? How about Maddie being like, so how old will he live? And she's like, no. You die together. Like, nice try.
But then she does say, you live long enough. Like, it was very surprising to me. I thought Maddie, the one who always seemed tunnel vision, that's one of the things that also cemented Roddy being future Roddy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, making this deal, you know, that's the change. And again, we don't know why. We didn't really get the change except for the fact that he's basically trying to tell us, I was always like this, when he talks to Annabelle. But that's not true, because he would have been a nice, cute little poet. But whatever. We already talked about that ad nauseum. We don't need to bring it up again. But yeah, this scene was amazing. It was what we were waiting for. Yeah. The deal with the devil.
The fucking cognac reveal, too.
Yes. Yeah.
Yes.
You drink this the best night of your life and the last night on earth. So good.
I want to bring up like a couple things that are just not conversation starters, but just cool little things I pulled from this, because I'm someone that pretty much I'd like detest religion, but I love it in fiction. You can check me on Midnight Mass. I love that shit. I love it in like fantasy books. I'm just not a big fan in real life. And I love that, like, she kind of leaned into the devil thing a little bit more here. Obviously, like, this is the most anticipated scene of the season, and I thought it was the best scene of the season. So like everything that was happening, I was just gripping onto every single word. And some things that she says is, Madeline mentions like a Bible story, which was cool, and even name drops the devil, which I like that. Then the one moment I really liked was, Madeline's like, oh, what are you going to take our souls or something? And she's like, you already sold them tonight. Like, that was a really cool moment. She also says, like, they don't exist. Again, more just religion lore in the Flanagan verse, I guess, is how it goes. Yeah. No souls. And then the third thing, which I'm shocked Paul didn't bring it up yet, because this is like a cool just saying, is when she says, after they make the deal, well, in the ancient world, we'd seal this with blood or spit and then later sign it on papyrus. Like, that was just so cool that it just shows you how, like, what a entity she is as like a religious force. So it's really just, because we got all of that like in this scene, and we didn't get much of it besides reading between the lines for the rest of the episode. So I like that they more than confirmed that she was the devil.
Love it. All right. Cool. So they walk out and they turn around and it's already not the bar, and everything gets fuzzy. They were drunk and stoned. They started remembering it differently. So then they never talked about it again. So that's, again, Luke and I kind of already said it. Thank God that
saved the show.
Saved. Seriously. Thank you, Mike. OK,
lots to do. You two, lots to do. I was like, oh, that line was great.
Mm-hmm.
So Pim. Just like Madeline. Madeline snaps the neck. Pim gets her in the neck, and she plays along just long enough to like get a fucking shits and giggles out of it, which is so funny. When she was like, "You had your little guy out there waiting," and I thought, "Fuck it, dying." She is such a star. Good. But let's talk about her talking about like knowing about the Trans Globe expedition, and like basically that the group left someone dead and they were probably doing bad things to women and all these things. They don't go into detail about things specifically besides the dead guy. But other than that, she just says, like, you know, another one of those lessons, like starvation, poverty, disease. You can fix all that with money, but you don't. You know what I mean? They do it like Viagra pills or whatever they say.
That was true. That number that she dropped about Viagra and the Pentagon, that's a legit number.
Yeah.
Which is ridiculous.
You pause cinema for a year and you could fix all your problems. That's crazy.
Yeah, that is wild. Also, this time I'm like, hey, we're not making movies and TV shows now. Does that mean things are getting better?
He was very meta these two episodes.
It was crazy. Also, just the Trans Globe expedition comes back into play, and she's like, you really don't remember me? I had to come up to the surface to see the boat and everything. I was like, that is just so fucking cool, man. I wanted more.
I said it earlier, but I'm so happy that it wasn't a throwaway line that Pim described it to Roderick, like time and space stood still. That was just such a subtle moment. I'm sure most people didn't even realize like when it happened.
I still think that her ring is like the ultimate Thule civilization group, whatever you want to call that or whatever. Thought that was cool. Also, does this just mean that like Arthur is a better person than any of the ushers because like he didn't take the deal and she said like thank you and then like kind of left? That's awesome.
Amazing.
This murderer is a better person.
Yep.
I want to go back really quick to the scene where they signed the deal with the devil. Just like every single thing she's ever done when it comes to the kids, Roddy, Maddie, it's all about choices. And she literally says, you can do with this what you will. You can do anything you want. And of course, they go drugs, greed. You know, they could have changed the world. Well, they did change the world, but they could have changed the world in a positive way. There's so many things they could have done. I love how when she's talking to these people, she alludes to it many times. She says, like, I love watching you and I love seeing what decisions you make. And she gives them the opportunity to have these decisions. You know, you can sell your soul to the devil and I'm giving you a choice. You can literally be the best person in the world. You can be Gandhi if you want, and you can change the world with everything I'm giving you, all these resources.
Yeah.
It just so happens that your bloodline's going to die, but, you know, you're going to live a long life. You're going to change the world for the better. You could do it that way. Or, you know, you can be what they were, greedy and just become all powerful and kill millions of people and, you know, whatever.
Yeah, there's something to be said. I think in the beginning when I was watching and she kept saying like, oh, you could have done this differently. It felt like there was almost a choice to not die, but there isn't. Everyone was always dying dead. No matter what. Yeah. And I wrote that note down too, James. It is worth talking about that. People, when given the choice, it's like people still just do bad things. It's just human nature to just do fucked up things. It's bad. But the last thing I'll say about Pim is saying, you know, I don't have collateral. Collateral is leverage and I won't be leveraged, which was hot. That was really hot of him.
That was awesome. What was the one line she said? Like I said to one of my clients, when I'm done, you can stand in the middle of Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody and it won't cost you a thing. Was that, that seemed like a super meta thing. And I Googled it, but I couldn't, like, who was one of her old clients that what she was talking about? Do you guys know? Was that like a famous in real world shooting?
No, I think she was just saying no consequences ever. Yeah. You could literally do anything you want. No consequences.
It's a slap on the wrist with a blowjob. You know,
love that.
Gotcha.
All right.
He was very professional and courteous when he declined the offer. Yeah.
I thought she was like gonna not like it, but she loved it, and it was just so badass of him to do that. We covered everything, but this was one of the last scene was the most expected, like obvious it was gonna come scene. This was not something I expected at all, like a Pim and a Verna talk. But when he got her and like sedated her and started wrapping her up, like, I was just kind of not thinking about this like a show. Like, I was just living in the moment, kind of like Ted Mosby. And I was thinking that what are the chances that Verna was the one in the basement, like doing the knocking? I was like, if that happens, I was going to lose my mind. Like, if he actually got her into the basement like that. But then I was like, wait, this is a joke. Like, it would have been cool in the moment, but then no.
Yeah.
And then I brought it up earlier and I'm just going to say it again. Like, one of the coolest things that we didn't predict was that part of the deal that they made protected Pim because he was like under their shield of can never lose a lawsuit. And that just like goes back to him doing the crosswords in the courtroom. And also it indirectly basically changed all of Augie's life because he couldn't do anything to actually win any litigation. So that was like it's almost like a get out of jail free plot hole card.
So it explains what he was late to court like 30 minutes that one time and like nothing happened. The judge was like, whatever. Like, shit happened.
The show has more rewatch value than I thought it was going to have, thinking it was just going to be the cyclical thing. But all the reveals change a lot of things in hindsight. And I really enjoy that about this show.
All right, cool. Here's another unexpected thing. So they did a really good job at psyching us out about Lenore. Like, I had made a guess that Lenore's consciousness was uploaded into Madeline. Like, I don't know. I was just like, or Madeline's was uploaded into Lenore. I don't even know what I was trying to say. Either way, they did a good job with Lenore, quote unquote, contacting Roderick this whole series to make you think like, oh, she's not dead, or she's not, like, her body's not dead at least. But so, you know, this is Gen Z, baby. Lenore just wanted to fix everything. She wants to do good things. She's like, throw it all away. Start fresh. You have more money than we'll ever need. Let's do good things. Let's start fixing things. And then Verna's sitting on the bed and she's not having a good time with this one. With the rest, she was having a good time. But So the story she tells is that, you know, Maury recovers well, a few years and a bunch of PT and surgery. She inherits a sizable fortune and puts it to work immediately, gives most of it away, starts a nonprofit. Millions and millions and millions of people are helped, you know, doing some good. And but she bops her and she's dead.
So, cleanest death that we're going to get all show. Yeah. But my only comment is just that I think that this was a very good scene specifically for Verna, like characterizing her more than just like the embodiment of evil. So that's, I just like the layers that she added when she's like, I don't like to do this.
Yeah. I told him the terms were clear. It shouldn't be on me to spell out the definition of the word bloodline.
Yeah.
Yeah. That sucks. And it's just so interesting to see Verna like this, like sad and somber and actually like, sorry. Jimmy, I thought we were getting something with our little theory about Lenore not actually being Freddie's daughter, because like,
yeah,
I thought you made it and I thought you that was gonna escape, and I thought it was gonna be like a whole issue or a whole like slap in the face to Roddy saying like Lenore is my favorite, Lenore is like the best of us, and Lenore isn't even an Usher. I thought that was gonna be a thing, but this was beautiful in its own sense, just the way that, you know, it all went down. She wasn't happy about it. Even the way that Roderick found her, like it was just her body on the bed. It was nothing nearly as horrible as discovering the bodies of the other siblings. This was kind of like the final straw.
I mean, this is what the other siblings could have had if they weren't assholes, right?
Yeah,
this is what they could have been.
And Roddy took this 100% the hardest.
Yeah.
Of any of his kids dying, Lenore, he took the worst. He thought this was awful. And Verna says, you know, I love my job, but I don't love all aspects of it. And like you said, it's a great speech that Carla Gugino gives, explaining all the good that's going to come to this world because of Lenore, but sorry. And there's the bop.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And then we get this little bit between Roderick and Augie about Madeline having a sentient AI project. So this is kind of the reveal of like the banging going on downstairs. And he's like, Lenore's dead. And he's like, no, Lenore's not dead. And she's like, this is just a bot. And it's a bunch of Nevermore texts, which is a Edgar Allan Poe thing.
Isn't that also the name of the school on Wednesday?
Yeah.
Yes. Nevermore School
Academy.
Nice.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So now we have boardroom, dead people, all the kids. Incredible. Love to have. I'm sure they loved taping that, just like all bloodied up and just chilling. No words, just vibes. I love
and
that.
Harry's probably
easy
like,
day.
My gosh, I have to get all done up and all this makeup every single time you need me for 1 second.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Roddy's just yelling at them, like angry, still scolding, trying to teach him a lesson. And it was like, come on, bro. They're not going to talk back.
Yeah. This is going to be one of the scenes that sticks with me when I'm like 5 years down the road, just thinking about this show, just like the imagery of it not being rain was so cool to me. And it was just the bodies and his legacy. And it was building up to the pyramid, even towards the end, you just saw it. That was just like, it didn't need to happen. And it was, I'm so happy that it did, like it in the way that he decided to show us. I thought that was a beautiful scene.
That's your true monument. I was like, ooh, that line hits pretty hard.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so Verna's the one who tells him to call Augie, which is interesting. So then that's like you said, Paul, those seats are for the boys. So he gets them, you know, you're going to tell all, bitch. This is your tell all memoir. Let's fucking go. But first, we have Madeline walking in. And I loved this Madeline Roderick scene. Like the energy Madeline was bringing, like they really felt like siblings. Like me and Jimmy could have been sitting across the table being like fucking around at the end of our life. Like just being like, damn, like we built a life out of nothing but dirt and trauma. And I just thought like they were, the chemistry was really good. Like they felt like siblings, like twins, like, you know what I mean? Like, and what would we have done different if we thought Verna was real? She goes on the spiel and she says, like, I got an IUD because I believed it enough that I got an IUD, which for all the boys out there is birth control, meaning like it's a thing you stick in. So like, it's not like you're taking pills. It's like something inside of you that's like
procedure. It's permanent.
Yeah. I mean, they last
well,
like,
you have to
every
get them
5 years or
yeah,
whatever. But
right.
Anyway, this is the Viagra bit that Madeline says, like the world will spend billions on Viagra, but nothing on like the serious diseases, and they're taking away rights from women, turning men into cum fountains and women into factories. I mean, just absolutely like gorgeous writing.
These fucking monsters, these fucking consumers.
Yeah. What did you think about the scene? Did you love it as much as me?
Oh, yeah. This was fucking insane. And she's going off of this tangent and she's so reserved and like usually pretty calm and just does the smart thing. So to see her just get unhinged and go off and just be mad at other people, like, oh, yeah, they blame us, but they made the decision to use it. They made the decision to abuse it. And now they're angry, even though so it was just a beautiful moment because like Roderick is like looking at Madeline's whole time, like with almost in awe, like his eyes are tearing up and you can tell that there's something going on in the background too. So just to lean into that a little bit in the beginning, when they're talking about like, why are they even down here? He goes on to say like, she's giving us a few minutes to talk, so there must be something to wrap up. So he just made that up, right? Because he wanted to honor her and like give her that tribute mummification thing. That's how I was getting it. So he just made up that, you know, lie about giving us time to wrap up. But in the first time I heard it, I was like, I love that. I love that he kind of gets it at this point, because he was talking about, you know, now Freddy's going to jump out and scare me and, you know, and then I'm going to have to go in the story. It was kind of like leaning into that. And he was just kind of going with the, you know what, whatever Verna wants at this point.
Let's end it, right? So we'll talk about the full end, any details. So Augie's so fucking confused at this point. He's like, what do you mean it's Madeline? What do you mean? And she finally comes out all crazy, chokes him out. I think she was still alive down there because she has to die with him. Chokes him out with her last breath. And then Augie has this line that's like, deep and dank tarn at my feet, close sullenly and silently over the fragments of the house of Usher. And if that isn't silence lay steadily on the walls and whatever of Hill House and whatever walked there walked alone. I mean, I had chills. I'm like, that felt like an ode to my sweet, sweet Hill House. And I loved it. But Juno inherits everything. What a queen. She dissolves it. Every dollar went to rehab. She weaned herself off. She did the 3 agonizing years. She crushed it. Arthur was arrested. Augie's last FU was to not do anything with the tape and then to just be with his family, because that's what life's all about. And he said, fuck you, and basically just left his tell-all for someone to steal and write a book and make millions off of.
Yeah.
I'll just go first for just this whole ending blurb here. Yeah. I'm going to include some of the ending of like them actually dying, because I thought one of the best, most epic depictions in this entire season was as soon as the building collapses and it's Verna just like with the darkness and the lit up eyes and just looking there. And then he turns away and it comes back and it's the Raven. I thought that was just like the epitome of epic. And I thought it was fucking awesome to see. I know why I have the note, but I can't remember what Roderick is talking about. Right before he dies, he has like one final really badass moment where I forget what Augie says, but he goes, I bet I still could have sold it. What was that in relation to?
He was basically being like, on the pills, if I wrote what they really were on the pills, yes. I bet
so
I
cool.
could
have
sold
is,
it.
He's like, I bet I still could have sold
Nevermore.
It. The lemonade scene is going to stick with me forever. And dude, yes. Roderick just gets it, man. He's so good.
Big time.
So many good things here. Just Roderick saying, I sent her off like a queen. Her popping up with the sapphire eyes and that whole bit. And it just looked terrifying. The line where Augie's like, are you sure after you honored her that she was dead? And he was like, you know, maybe not. Makes perfect sense. Our mother was the same way. And I'm like, yeah, because you thought your mother died and she really wasn't dead. And it was just such a his sly little line. And then, honestly, when the whole house was coming down, Augie's booking it. Did you guys see that slide he had to the front door? He had like a 2-footed little glide. Yep. And I was like, you smooth bastard. You definitely could moonwalk back in the day, couldn't you?
Yeah, I don't need to say anything else that you guys have already said. Just obviously, the symbolism with how Eliza killed Longfellow with the choke out and then passing out, dying right on top of him.
Oh, yeah, totally.
Made me think, and it's not a thing, and I'm just going through it in my head. It's just funny to me to say, but, you know, how crazy would it have been if Longfellow and Eliza made that same deal with Verna, because Longfellow got everything he wanted, the kids die, and she goes to the kids and they die the same exact way. Like they're dying literally. It's not.
Like
it's not.
That. No, that's I mean, a cool idea. Though.
The bloodline thing would have killed them immediately. Like when whoever made the deal has already been dead. But I like that, James. Yeah.
Right. They would have had to die after their bloodline died. They died they first.
Like whoever made the deal. So if it was Billy, then they would have died as kids because he died when she killed them.
Right. Know that's what, I mean? What I'm saying. Yeah. They would have had to die for him to see, just like Roddy saw. Yeah. So it's just the symbolism, though, with the two deaths is really circle of life, man. Circle of life.
How about Augie's line after he's talking to the tombstones? He lays the recording at the grave and he's like, you know what? I'm going home to my husband and our kids. And their kids. I'm the richest man in the world. You know that? I was like, oh, God, that is such a good fucking line.
All right, Luke, did you have questions for us or something?
So we kind of answered the majority of them. So I think let's just all give our quick little summary of this experience as a whole. And then we'll do the just quick rankings of how we rank the Flanagan verse. I know we're at the end. So I just want to say a couple of things just like in general. Like I've said it already. I'll say it again. Like I loved this show. I thought it was really, really good. I was a little upset that QB1 didn't develop as much as I wanted to see on screen. And then my other complaint, which I didn't even really harp on too much, I actually didn't bring it up, was I kind of felt like the whole AI angle and the phone fake out thing wasn't good enough for me. Like I felt like the whole show was kind of there and it wasn't a big enough reveal for me to really care. Those are like my two biggest things, but like the jester was like way better than I could have imagined. Him, like Luke Skywalker was out of this world. Like I never saw the Verna scene in him playing out as good as it did. The bar scene wasn't fantastic. The acting was top tier across not just Flanagan shows, which are known for good acting, across like almost any show I've ever seen. And I love the ending. I thought it was arguably one of the, I would say the finale of this season is a top three Flanagan episode. That we'll have to sit on that a little bit more, but that's probably where I'm at with this show as a whole. And hinting at that, I think Oscar is number two. Should I just give my rankings and then let you guys go?
Go ahead.
Yeah.
So, and I'm going to add in tiers just so you guys can know the differences, but it's like Haunting of Hill House is like S tier, top tier TV. Usher is like right at the top of the next tier. Bly is probably a little bit lower than that. Pretty huge gap, like a couple tiers down. Then I'm at Midnight Mass, followed by Midnight Club. Just those, the Midnights didn't really do it for me, especially Club, because we didn't get the ending. But overall, like Usher was the second best, man. I think this was so good. We said it before, like this was an Avengers moment for all of his actors. I'm really happy this was like his final Netflix project. And hopefully he takes a bunch of these same actors. Is he going to Amazon next? Do we know that?
Yep.
Yeah, that's
Amazon.
Just,
yep.
Hopefully a blind check. Keep going. Bring everybody in. Let's keep it going. Because right now, like that was... I'm hot for this for Flanagan, man, bro. He kills it, man. Like, we were going down a little bit because Midnight Mass and Midnight Club were his last two, and I thought they were his worst two, and now we're back. So we're on the rise again. So I'm pretty happy. And this was like
all
a
rise, baby.
Show. Yeah.
Yeah. Mine, same order as yours. I think that the Fallout of Usher can be better in some aspects than Haunting of Hill House, but the Haunting of Hill House is just so damn good. The way they tell the story and the story itself, that's got to be one. Yeah, same thing. It's just like Haunting, Fall of the House, Usher, Bly Manor, and then the rest is confetti.
Oh,
the rest is confetti, dude.
Got me. Go ahead, James. Yeah,
I was looking right at Kathleen as I said that. I was like,
I'm gonna use my time to instead ask a question to you guys that I want to know what you think. Because Luke, I think you nailed it perfectly. My thoughts on the show, on the rankings, I agree. Hill House number one, Usher number two, all the rest is confetti. It's exactly how you guys said it. I think that still Hill House is one and Usher is, there's some space there.
Yeah.
I think that there is some arguments to be made about Bly, because there are a lot of people, and I was looking up their rankings, and a lot of people even have Bly 1, and there are people that have Bly 2, and their reasoning is kind of the reasoning Kathleen has. So my reasoning for why Bly is 3 is I understand how really, really, really good it is, but I was expecting horror, and I got a love story, and I can understand how good that is, but that disappointed me. But if you're someone who can almost be non-biased or prefer the love story, then you can easily put it as one or two. So I just want to say that. But my question to you guys is, there's, I feel like I said alluded like 15 times in this podcast, but they both, Maddie and Roddy, allude to the fact that, yes, thank gosh they said that it was all fuzzy and they just decided not to believe it was real and all that. But Roddy does say, as things are happening, I started to remember and I started to believe it might be true. And Maddie obviously remembers something because she admits she got the IUD. Is Roddy just way more of a POS than we even can realize? Because he realized that this happened, maybe. If he realizes just as much as Maddie realizes it, he still brings these children into the world.
Like, I'm saying she got an IUD all the way back then, like she still had some memory of like what happened.
That she decided never to have kids because she remembered the deal.
Yeah, and I think he said, like, I kind of knew it all along. And then he's like, when they were sitting at the table, Verna looked him in the eye and was like, would we have changed if we thought she was legit, if we knew she was legit? No, the answer is no. Like, yeah, piece of shit. Huge piece of shit.
Yeah, you're right.
Just like Luke.
I mean,
I wouldn't have kids in the first place.
Luke, a gigantic piece of shit.
I'm not Maddie, bringing though. Kids in
Yeah,
to die,
exactly.
So
Luke is Maddie. Luke would not have... Right, right. Luke is totally Maddie with the logical sense where he wouldn't have the kids. He wouldn't be the one saying, oh, fuck them, I'm going to have all these kids.
Yeah.
That is, that is a good angle, but also, that we didn't really talk a lot about. I agree. He is a piece of shit.
Jimmy's having a little connectivity problems. If you can get it together by the end of my spiel, then we'll let him finish his spiel. But okay, so my thing, I think you guys have insane recency bias. I'm going to call you guys out. I am currently getting my heart broken by Haunting of Hill House for the seventh time. It is phenomenal ounce per ounce. Like, the way you fall in love with these characters and the way Mike intertwines these stories, and they're all flip-flopped, and there's not a single flaw in the entire show. Like, I really think, I don't know when the last time you three watched Hill House was, but you need to rewatch it soon. It is like the greatest. I'm watching this like getting my heart shattered every second, and I'm giggling. I love these people. I'm obsessed. I'm just like, it's the best. So Hill House is up here. And I'm sticking with Bly. I need to like sit with Usher, rewatch it again. But Bly's my number two. Jimmy said, like, you know, to me, it was horror. Like, there was a lot of very creepy stuff in Bly. Again, I rewatched it recently. Like, it's not scary. Like, all the stuff, like the lady in the lake is fucking freaky. Like, Flora with the damn dolls, like, everything's kind of scary, and that big creaky house, like, I would say it's pretty hard, yet it ended up being a love story. But I would say that Bly is still one of the scarier ones. I don't think Usher was scary at all. Like, I think the only scary thing about Usher was the kills, and that's not scary. That's like more slasher. Like, I would say it's more thriller than scary. So I would even argue that Usher isn't really horror either. So I
don't think I used the horror as any of my justifications for ranking.
Jimmy did.
Oh, okay. Jimmy I thought you were saying in general.
No.
I do remember Bly being creepy, especially Lady of the Lake or whatever.
Yeah. So I've got Hill House, easy one, Bly two, Usher right below Bly. Like, I mean, like right below Bly. And then the other two are just like a toss up. Midnight Club has to be last because it didn't get finished.
Right.
But I need to rewatch Midnight Mass. I think the my top three are like easy rewatchables every Halloween. The other two I have yet to rewatch, and I probably will never rewatch Midnight Club. But Midnight Mass, I'm going to give another shot without having to take notes and just kind of sit and enjoy it because I had never gotten to do that. But either way, like Bly and Hill House to me are just so intimate. You fall in love with these characters because every episode you're only with this core group. And this one, just like the ensemble cast is like so large and you only get to spend a finite amount of time with them. I think that does something for me because I am an emotional little gal. So that's why those two are ranked higher. But phenomenal work by Flanagan. And Jimmy, I didn't mean to like smack it down on the horror stuff. That's just what I think because I watched it recently and it was like kind of creepy. Okay. Any parting shots? Jimmy's giving us the finger. Any parting shots?
No, I think just this was a win. I'm just so happy that we're back, baby, because Flanagan, when he's hitting, there's like almost nobody like him.
Yeah, totally. All right. Well, those are the episodes. We're going to try and get this out ASAP. I mean, by the time you're listening, it'll already be out. So it doesn't really matter what I say, huh? Anyway, hit subscribe on Binge on TV. Like I said in the beginning, that's our main feed. You won't miss an episode. If you're not watching Gen V, get on Gen V. We have all the boys coverage as well. So you can go back and listen to those. We're doing Survivor. So if you're a reality TV head like me, you can go listen to our Survivor coverage. And then anything else we've done and all of the Flanagan shows we've covered. So go listen. Thanks for coming on this ride with us. We love the feedback, whether it's on Discord or it's on email, like Laura sent or like Alicia sent last week. We loved that. So come talk to us. Tell us stuff about Edgar Allan Poe, because we're, again, like I said, illiterate and we don't know anything. So please help us with that. And we are Binge Town TV, and the rest was confetti.
Nice.
You're listening to the Geekscape Network.